Welcome to Sunday World Engage, a platform where we converse and we don't judge people of public interest in the South African public life. And today we have a special guest in the form of the Speaker of the National Assembly, as well as a member of the National Executive Committee of the African National Congress. Many former in many positions, but we'll talk all about it during the interview. That is Umama Uthokozile Angela Didiza. Mama, salam again. Otherwise, Mama, how has it been the parliament as a speaker? Of course, when you've been there before, so I'm sure it was not a shock thing.
Well, it was a shock.
Okay.
Because the responsibilities are not necessarily the same. Yes, I've been a member of parliament for a number of years, starting in 1994 until 2008, where I left parliament and government and came back again in 2014. So in 2014 to 2019, I was a member of parliament and a house chairperson for internal arrangements. House chairpersons are actually nominated by the speaker and then approved by the National Assembly to assist the Speaker in her work. You'd know that those that are directly elected, it's the Speaker and then the Deputy Speaker. After that, the Speaker will then identify three members in the National Assembly who will then assist and be part of the Speaker's office, assist in various responsibilities, including the chairing of the House. So I'm saying it was different because when you are a House chairperson, you are given particular responsibilities that you focus on, but the entirety of executive management of the institution lies with the Speaker. So those responsibilities are not, I would say, of the equal value, but they're equally important.
No, 100%. But did you expect it at all, Mama? I mean, given, of course, this is a new dispensation of the GNU and an ANC that doesn't have outright majority. So I'm sure many comrades were worried about prospects of, continued employment within the body politic. So when it happened to you, when we were approached, that look would like for you to stand for speaker, did it come as a surprise?
It was. First and foremost, in the different political parties, they would have different systems of how members become members of parliament. In the African National Congress, for instance, it started a very low level of a branch, which is the basic unit of the organization, where you get nominated into a list, either the national to national list or province to province list. That goes to a particular process where you have got the elections commission that then looks at the ordering of the list, where you are. And it depends on the number of votes that you have in terms of the party that then determines how many members out of the national list and the province to national will be able to go to parliament. And one takes it as a responsibility, because it's not a given, it doesn't mean other members who have not been in the list cannot be able to do the work that you do as a public representative. It also doesn't mean that those at that particular moment who may be where they are in the list have not been able to come back are not worthy or capable of undertaking that task, because all of us understand that by allowing yourself to be in that list and be a public representative comes with particular responsibilities that you have to undertake. Firstly, you owe allegiance to the constitution, to the country, and secondly, your party has got a manifesto or a template which they actually commit to the citizens when they go to, to mobilize the votes as to what are the things that they would do should they be given an opportunity to lead. So those issues become very paramount, or should be paramount in your mind, to say you are not there for your own good, but you are there to serve, and you are there to actually ensure that you make your contribution in changing people's lives.
And then, Mamdlambe, before we go deeper, let's start it right at the back. How were you introduced into politics?
Wow. I would say it came at different points.
Yeah.
One, I think at home, my dad was very conscious and aware of what was happening in our society. And news bulletin, even though it was radio at the time, we had no TV at home, he would make all of us to keep quiet because he wanted to listen to the news. So obviously, you are quiet, you end up listening, and you end up understanding what it is. But also, one had a stint in Swaziland because mom and dad both became teachers in Swaziland, mom being from Eswatini herself. And one was able to see the difference between the two countries and started to question why, you know, certain things happened the way they were happening in this country and not in another country. And therefore, the issue of segregation became much more clearer at the time. But being at a primary level at that early age, when 1976 uprising took, you know, effect, I was doing Standard 5. And listening to the news, I think the question that was uppermost in my mind was, what type of a government can actually mow down children? And unfortunately, some of those kids would have been my age. Mm. And for whatever reason, which I cannot explain, my dad decided that we will go, my sister, my brother, myself, we will attend Ohlange High School. And, you know, after Standard 5, I had applied. I was taken at Manzimtoti. I was taken at Langezwe, you know. But for some reason, he just decided that you go to Ohlange. And I was like, oh, yeah, why?
Yeah.
And then arriving in that school, you know, you look at the outlook of the school. It was like, why?
Yeah.
It didn't look as appealing. So the first day we went to class, but before that we started at chapel for the morning prayers and welcoming of the new teachers and the new students. And at the end of that morning prayers, all newcomers were asked to remain behind to learn the national anthem. I mean, not the national anthem, the school anthem.
Yes.
Okay, there was our choir master, Mr. Kumalo, who then taught us this school anthem, Mafukuzela Onjenge Zulu. And as you listen to the lyrics, I think what touched me was, wow, an African person who built a school determined that, you know, Africans must stand on their own and be able to do things that can change their conditions. I was like, wow. And then at the end of that first practice, because it went on for about 2 weeks, because we had to sing notes, do, re, mi, fa, so. And then the choir master said to us, let's walk around the room. There were photos that were on the wall of the chapel at school. So you looked at this Luthuli, Nsihlele, Mdima, Charles, and who are these people? And he didn't explain. by the end of the week, curiosity got the better of me and some of the students. We decided to go to the library to get to understand who are these people, because he made sure that every day we do that tour before we exit. But he would not say why. And it was the first time that one got to know Albert Luthuli, president of the ANC in the 60s. This John Langalibalele Dube Mafuzel, the first president of the African National Congress. Then you get to say, okay, what is this ANC?
Yes.
What does it stand for? Then you go deeper. And you then understand also the way the school community, that even the teachers themselves were very politically aware and conscious. And then you start to develop the interest. And I think that's where, for me, the connect between what was happening in Soweto in 76 and 77, I mean, you start to...
Things start making sense.
They start making sense. Mm. And I think that's where the political activism all cultivated.
Mm.
And I remember one of the things when I was doing, well, what is called grade 10 now, but form 3 as we called it then.
Yes.
Our teacher, you know, who was teaching us English, Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka, she was Mlambo then, she was our teacher. She had just come out of the University of Roma to come and teach in our school, would ask us to contribute money to buy the newspapers, and then would allocate each one of us to read, and then you will come and share with the class the story you read, you know, analysis of it. In the first instance, it looked like encouraging us to learn English and expand, but also to appreciate what was happening in our world, around us. But later it became clear that this was some kind of concertization.
Yes.
And sometimes she would bring in, you know, people. I remember one of the people who she brought was Mamsi Kubete, who was a nutritionist, who came to talk to us about the importance of food security and how food can actually, its scarcity can actually be a source of conflict in the world.
Mm.
And one of the people she also brought in was Advocate Mwerane, who came in to talk to us about our rights, understanding your rights, you know, in terms of the civil rights and so on. And it started to make sense, because at that time people were being arrested, and so you knew what you had to do if... So, I mean, you read it between the lines to say...
Yeah, I'm being treated.
Yeah. You know, so... And I think one of the things that became clearer for me, for others in our school, you knew that you can't just accept anything which comes from the establishment without questioning.
Yes.
We also, when it was not fashionable in that school, had the SRC, who were able to engage with the administration about the running of the school. And fortunately, midstream, we then had another principal who had been a student at the school, so who understand the culture of the school. And once a year, we had, during September, Mafuzela Week.
Yes.
Where, you know, we also got other family members of Mafuzela and also, you know, other speakers who will speak about Mafuzela, but also about what happened to him, you know, in terms of his political activism, which further, you know, sharpened or contributed in your political development. And once a year also, when we came, you know, to the school, The first Friday, we all went to Mafuzela's house. Mama Angelide was still alive, so we will sit there on the grass and she would welcome us back to the school, and then she will talk to us about Mafuzela and his comrades, why they started the school, why was it important, why the struggle for freedom remains important even today. So I would say that community, having been in that environment, did a lot in awareness raising, but also in political consciousness. And I think during that moment, in my view, it was not a choice to take a stand. It was not a choice to become politically active. It's something that was a necessity.
Yes.
It was clear that if this movement towards the liberation of our country is not, you know, continued by our generation, in addition to those who had already been there before us,
yes,
it would not happen.
Interesting, Mama. Napegwa, Gamnandi, but nina nesaba pegi the young ones of now, by the way.
Well,
in fact,
do.
What happened to those kind of, you know, I'll call it political grooming? Because these days, I mean, the current young leaders, really, they lack basic political, you know, upbringing.
I would say it's in two ways.
Yeah.
We still do, maybe not to that extent, but also I would challenge and say, in the fraternity of the media and communications where you are, I think post 94 there was a disconnect.
Okay.
Where yourselves have maybe not been sure how you interface in the new environment of freedom.
Yes.
And maybe seeing that what we need to talk about is the rebuilding without actually connecting the past and the future. And I'm saying that because if you look at the role that journalists played in the struggle for freedom, using their pen, using their tools of communication, did a lot in enhancing, you know, that political development, where you were able to report objectively on situations. I think all of us made a mistake that we assumed that once we attain political freedom, everything will just fall in place.
Yeah.
And I always say in the African tradition, there's always something very interesting where oral history is told. Your family history, for instance, it's not in the books.
Mm.
It has been through your grandmother, grandfather, the uncles and the aunts, who will tell you about certain people in the family who did particular, you know, work. It goes to the neighbors, it goes to the village. And so you know who you are, not just as utoko wakamsane, but omsane bangobani, omota, where my mother come from, bangobani, why are they important? But also, what did they do in the community as part of their contribution?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that is historical, that becomes important in your present and the future. And I think politically where, in my view, all of us have missed it, including this fraternity,
yes,
of the media people, is being able to help the younger generation understanding the past as well as their role in the present of rebuilding. You cannot, in my view, rebuild when you don't have the history.
I understand.
So it in terms of our curriculum at school, maybe it's not much of that, but also in society, how do we ensure that we build young people to understand that this freedom wasn't free, but also this freedom was an enabler to be better than what your parents were today? But how do you, in this present, also build a country that your children will benefit from? Mm. How do we ensure that the values we propagate are the values that build the nation? And I think in the contestation of media, sometimes certain symbols and communication does, in my view, I may be wrong, impact our younger people negatively. One, creating individualism.
Yeah,
two, not caring about community. It's like angnandaba.
Mm.
And this thing of not being focused about the future is like a sobonakon, you know? There's nothing there to bonakon. Yeah. Like things happen in a particular way.
Yes.
So we then have adopted subcultures, in my view, that sometimes those who have got the tools of communication propagate, and you lose a community or you lose a generation that has to come. I mean, if you look at it, there's a role, in my view, for the state, but also there's a role of the family and the community.
True. That's where it starts.
You see, and in terms of responsibility, it's something that you learn at home. So how do you interface where children must understand that they contribute in this household by making their beds, by cleaning, doing the chores at their level, rather than deferring that this thing somehow will happen? Kokwam used to say, amabhoto akangcizwa
ayayiphekwa.
So it's those things, in my view, that you know that there are certain things that you must do to contribute to a better whole. But at the same time, how do we build a community? How do we resolve problems without fighting? But also acknowledging that we may have differences of opinion, but we still respect one another as human.
Yes. You spoke, Mama, of Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka as your teacher. I understand that post that over time you continued with that relationship up to the point of her becoming your political mentor. I think that's the term I heard from some corners. How has she contributed towards your building as a public servant, as a person in politics and just broadly in the state?
Well, I must say that in life you meet different people at different times.
Yes.
I met her when I was at school. And then when I continued, she also had other engagements elsewhere, where she ended up going out of the country, employed by the World University Service in Geneva. At that time, I continued being an activist.
Yes.
Here at home. So I would say there are many people who shaped the person that I am, some of them present, some departed, because when you are an activist, you work with a collective, you are not alone.
Yes.
So, I mean, you have got people like Babu Ian Mkize, who I worked with while I was at Diakonia, Ntombi Hadebe. I worked in the legal firm of Mafika Mbuli and Company, where I worked with people like Gwenza Mlaba, people like Zom Pele and Sam Nkosi, together with Mafika Mbuli. And at the time, it was in the midst of the repression in our country, and most of the cases that they dealt with in that firm was actually political cases, but also you get to interface with different people in that fraternity and understanding how the importance of law, you know, is in this context. People like Linda Zama, those are some of the people I worked with, people like Sbun Debele, bumped in life together, we worked with Abo Jeff Khadebe. But there are many, Abo Mam Bokela, Abo Mam Florence Mkize, Abo Mam Sisno Zizwe Madala. So there are many people, I think, each one of them made a particular
way
in shaping your political growth and political development. And also, I would say some of the tasks that we were given at the particular time, yes, under the guidance of some of the comrades who were senior than us, enabled you to get corrected where you made mistakes, but also sharpened you to self-development by asking particular questions as to why do we do things in this way. So I also worked with people like the late Jesse Juwate in the women's movement, people like Gertrude Fester, Zeni Chongweni, Nomvula Mokonyane, Nana Mnandi, Batabile Dlamini, and others.
Yeah.
You know, so I cannot count.
No, I see.
How many.
The list is very long.
The list is many because some of them we interfaced, as I say, in the women's movement, but also in the civil society organization. I worked with the women's movement, the Young Women Christian Association, where I worked with people like Omamu Joyce Seroge and Abomamu Tabashe from Claremont, Nabo Tipia Nyembezi, and Abomamu Mhlambi from Newcastle and others. But also within the ecumenical movement, when I was working in Diakonia, working with a number of churches, Abo Bishop Haley of the Roman Catholic Church at the time, Bishop Hudson of the Methodist Church, Abo Reverend at the time, Nyobole of the Methodist Church, and working with Abo Babu Frank Chikade and others. So there are many people in these different walks of life that one interfaced with that contributed the growth. But also when, you know, we had to interface with the liberation movement prior to its unbanning outside, there are many of those comrades who one interfaced with, learned from them.
Yes, 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 ma'am. And then at this time as a speaker, you are a speaker at a time where one of the foremost or important issues is international relations, especially as it relates to us, South Africa, for various reasons. Maybe the question to you would be, what role is Parliament playing, if any at all, in shaping our foreign policy at this point in time where we seem to be somewhere at the center of these geopolitical wars that are going on?
Well, I think Parliament has always made a contribution in terms of diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather international relations work. Parliament is a member of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, as part of the SADC Parliamentary Forum, which will now become a full parliament a few years to come, once the protocol by all countries have been signed. We also are a member of the Pan-African Parliament,
mm-hmm.
Which is the organ of the African Union. We are also a member of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Africa Region and International, as well as the member of the Inter-Parliamentary Union, and now the BRICS Forum. So those are the platforms that Parliament uses to actually influence the multilateral system, but also the geopolitics. We do have committees in Parliament, such as the International Relations Committee, which deal with those matters and engage with the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, and also hold it accountable, I mean, in terms of the minister in the executive. But we also have debates in Parliament where we reflect on some of these issues of the geopolitical nature and, you know, firm up what our propositions are. But we must also remember that we're a multi-party institution.
Parliament, yes.
So at times, there may be issues of difference on approaches,
yes,
on how we deal with some of the matters, because some of the political parties may be aligned with a particular international bodies or parties in a particular way. So it's always how that gets managed.
Yes, Mama. But then, in fact, while we're still on geopolitics, how? But I'll ask you this with a wider question. But the original question: how does Parliament enforce resolutions that it takes and make sure that if they have to be implemented by another arm of state, they are implemented? The reason I'm asking it this way: for instance, Parliament took late last year a decision that the Israeli embassy must be closed.
Actually, that decision was taken by the sixth administration.
Oh, it was taken previously?
Yes.
So was that a rehashment in last year? Because I remember it was
Last year, it was more a question that arose, I think, in the House, where other members of the House wanted to know when is the executive moving in that direction following that resolution that was taken by Parliament.
Yeah, exactly. But the question then still stands, how does Parliament enforce and make sure that its decisions are implemented if they have to be implemented? Remember, you are an oversight body to the National Executive. So when the National Executive doesn't act on decisions or resolutions of Parliament, what recourse is in place?
Well, let me say, there are various steps that you follow. Remember that when an administration comes to an end and a new one
comes in,
sometimes there are changes in the reconfiguration of the executive.
Mm-hmm.
New ministers come in who also must then familiarize themselves about some of those decisions that have happened. So you have to allow space and time for the ministers to get familiar with their portfolios. That doesn't mean you are letting them off the hook in terms of the decision that Parliament has taken. For instance, in that matter, we have written to the minister about that resolution and asking how far the process is. And minister did respond that they are working on the issue. So we are awaiting his communication on how they would deliberate on that matter.
Mm. And you see, also maybe a question that arises from this again, Mama Ileoguti, for instance, the Zondo Commission, where Parliament was also discussed in how it handled issues in the period of the administration that was under question at the Zondo Commission, it made findings or recommendations that Parliament was sort of lackluster in terms of doing its work in holding members of the executive accountable. And then that's why some of these things went on and on unabated. What have you done as Parliament, maybe to narrow the question, what has Parliament done in response to what the Zondo Commission report said about the work of Parliament?
Even though a commission will make its recommendations,
yes, yes,
will make its assessment, but also you have to also reflect on certain things that happened in Parliament. For instance, if you recall, before even the Zondo Commission, Parliament had started doing an inquiry on ESCOM based on its oversight work, where they realized that there were certain things that were not going okay in our state entities. That report was very deep and thorough, in my view, in getting to what things went wrong in the institution. And I do think that Parliament has been able at different occasions to do work that they need to do. If you look at the work that was done by the ad hoc committee on the matter of Nkandla. It was Parliament, without any other arm of state asking Parliament to do that work, as part of its oversight, to actually understand how the resources of the state were used. They called ministers and, you know, to
but
account
it was
for all of
whitewash,
those.
Was that ad hoc?
It wasn't. One of the things in any multi-party fora, you must understand that there may be differences of opinion among parties.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it's a whitewash. Because these parties represent different constituencies.
True.
But the fact that all of them went, observed, the determination on how they looked at the different things, it's another matter.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean no oversight work was done, in my view, to understand where things went wrong. Some of the things which we wouldn't have known, actually, about how many other departments were supposedly, and I will say supposedly, implicated. But sometimes some of the questions, in my view, arise because we may not understand what processes get followed in the executive or in parliament to do certain things, and what policy instruments may be there for certain things to be undertaken. So when it comes to the issue that, you know, arises out of an oversight, there will be a resolution that happens in the House on what must be done. And the Speaker will then write to the Minister concerned of that portfolio, together with the Leader of Government Business, to say, these are the resolutions of the House, kindly deal with them and report to us to say how far we have gone. But it's not limited to that. Question time in Parliament, it's part of oversight. To hold the executive to account, both written and oral questions. I think a lot of us look at oral questions because it's where we see them in front of the camera. But a lot of information gets written through written questions. But also members go on a Monday, which is Constituency Day, to do oversight in the various
constituencies
as individuals or as a collective.
Yes.
So a committee may decide, like it happened last year, where the Committee on Human Settlement wanted to go and understand what happened in that collapsed building in George as a committee. Sometimes a member of parliament may decide to go and see how the police stations are functioning, whether what the minister had said is what obtains at the level of the police station. And they will either write a question to say, I went to this question, or they will make a member statement, which ministers respond to say, this is what I found, and it's not like what minister you have done. That also is not just an oversight to say, this is what I've achieved, or this is what I've seen. It enables the executive to also follow up on those things and be able to report back to say, yes, I've seen this. It may be what you say. This is the remedial action that I'm taking as a minister to correct that situation. And these are the things that most of the time the public is never aware of.
Not true. Maybe we're also to blame. We don't report beyond what is theatrical, these sittings that...
Sometimes it is that issue.
Yes.
Going back to the issue I raised about the role of the media today is beyond the sound bites.
True.
What is the actual issue?
Yes.
So that you... I mean, there are very few journalists who will stay on the story until the end.
Hey, we chase the new one.
It's an
unfortunate culture.
The new one, and it's an unfortunate culture. But the other thing I found, which might be a criticism, that sometimes even the headline issues that we chase we never actually do a bit of investigation, particularly with social media now.
Yes, it's worse.
During this week, in the beginning of the week, there was an article that was being shared widely in social media, purported to be written by Joel Netshitenge. And when he came across it, he actually had to rebut it to say, I didn't write this article.
Mm.
The same article, a day after, came now authored by a different person.
Mm.
And the next day, it was authored by the different person. The same story. And this is what the good and the bad of your social media is.
Mm.
Which then also distort the way in which news gets, you know, disseminated. And sometimes journalists will pick those things and run with it without verifying whether, really? Is this...
Yeah, that's surely journalism.
And by the time you discover that it wasn't as it looked...
That the damage has been caused.
Damage is done. And I think it is also about... that balance.
Yes.
But also, how do we all collectively, beyond the theatrics, how do we build the country that we want?
Yes.
I'm not saying we mustn't be critical of the wrong things.
True.
But we must also be able to contribute towards building a society with particular values that we and our children would be proud of.
Mm-hmm. Mama, one of the other things I want to understand about Parliament is the Palapala report, which of course didn't pass in terms of the vote in Parliament. Was that where Parliament's role in the whole issue? Remember, you established a panel to investigate the issue. They came with a report which was put to the House. The House... Of course, the ANC at the time had majority. It kicked it out. Was that the end of Parliament's involvement on the Palapala issue?
Yes. Remember that in terms of the process that the former speaker followed, was having been asked by different parties that this matter must be dealt with, she actually appointed a panel which had to look whether there was an issue that would make, a case for impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
So that panel did its work, reported to the speaker, and the speaker had to send that report to the House for the House to discuss and debate and make its decision. And the House made its decision.
And that was the end of the issue?
That was the end of the issue. And remember that even during that process, while Parliament was doing what it was doing, law enforcement agencies were also undertaking their work. So you had the police doing their work, the NPA doing their work. So the process of Parliament did not stop the other arms of state to do the investigations that they were doing, the Reserve Bank, SARS. So there were many other agents of state that did their work in terms of that report.
Yes. One of the major complaints, Mama, about Parliament, which has been persistent now for at least since 2014, is about how Parliament handles disagreements between parties. I mean, sometimes it degenerates to argue scenes where people are manhandled, some women, and stuff like that. What do you think now as the head of that parliament is the ultimate resolution to resolving that issue and ending those things? Well, in fact, they happened just this week again.
You know what? Parliament, like any other institutions, have got rules and procedures, which regulate all of us.
Mm.
And those rules are not made by the speaker or any executive authority.
Yeah.
Is made by the Rules Committee, which is representatives of all parties.
Mm.
So what, there are rules that clearly talks to issues of language. you can't use particular language swearing at each other and accept that that's parliamentary. Parties themselves have said that cannot be. You've got rules that indicate how you conduct yourself in the House in terms of the debate. You've got rules about how disorderly conduct get addressed. For instance, if a member wishes to speak, there are rules that define that you raise a point of order. And when you raise a point of order, it stipulates in the rule, you must indicate under what rule you want to make a point. Either you want to actually ask for a privilege. So when you ask for a point of privilege, the speaker can allow you to say the matter that you want to raise, which is a matter of privilege, which has got nothing to do that might be happening in the House at the time. But secondly, if you raise a point of order in terms of a particular rule, you then have to indicate that you are raising a point of order in terms of this rule, and this is what it happens. But when you raise a point of order, allow the speaker to give you permission to do so. What we have seen is that some members actually break their own rules. A person just picks up the mic and
speak.
At times, the person speaks when there's somebody on the podium, which is destructive. So as a speaker, you have to protect, you know, the House, the members, because members want to hear what the one who's speaking, but also caution the other member to say, you can't just speak when you are not pointed. At times, members, there'll be a flurry of hands. You can't point all of them at the same time. You can point all of them, but each one must be given an opportunity to raise their matter. And sometimes other members don't respect that, which then creates a degeneration of the House. But thirdly, if in your point of order, the speaker indicates to you that that is not a point of order, it's a point of opinion, of debate. If it's a point of debate, you have got an opportunity when your time comes to debate. But you can't use a point of order to actually engage on a debate because it is wrong. You actually are distracting the House. And remember, it's not only you in this House, it's all other members.
Yes.
And it's the public also who is interested in hearing what the issue is about. But when you persist, the speaker will actually caution you. And you continue with that same behavior, speaker cautions you. The third time, the speaker will ask you to leave the chamber because it means you're not interested in hearing another point of view. You just want to disrupt the House. And ideally, all members know, if you are asked to leave the House, you must leave the House. Other members deliberately want to be removed. So I'm just saying that at times we look at it as though the speaker just, no speaker reaches that point of removal without giving a member, you know, a caution to say, sometimes if a member uses unparliamentary language, the speaker will say, withdraw.
How has the parliament at least handled the issue that was a main point of debate on that issue of these violent removals, where there was an issue that now there some of these bouncers, some call them, are mishandling women? How did you intervene in terms of that?
No, let me say, firstly, there are no bouncers in parliament.
Yes.
You've got the protection services.
Yes.
And those protection services, their responsibility is to protect all members of parliament.
Mm-hmm.
You have got in the house the sergeant at arms who carries that mace when the speaker comes in the house. His or her responsibility is to assist the speaker when a member has to be escorted out. I'm sure you see most of the time the sergeant at arms will come to a member and talk to a member to say, please leave the chamber. And that is after the speaker herself had already
told them,
asked the member to leave. And sometimes other members just decide to refuse. So the sergeant at arms might actually ask the member to go. Other members will be violent. And that's where your protection services is then called to assist.
Mm. Well, another issue now that is current is that now you have the protectors of the members of the executive actually being present inside the chamber. What do the rules say in that regard?
Well, the rule is very clear. That's why the deputy speaker at the time had to ask them to leave the chamber. But also remember, they were actually in the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But still, she asked them to actually leave the chamber.
Mm.
So I'm just saying that the challenge is that things that sometimes happen in parliament without members of society having a background understanding of the rules might not understand why certain things happen the way it happens. But it goes back to the issue, in my view. How do we want to create institutions that we respect and that must be respected?
Mm.
As I said earlier, the rules that govern parliament are rules made by the members. So it is incumbent to members themselves to respect their own rules. They should be the first who actually understand that, I've made a mistake here, I must withdraw. I mean, like, for instance, a member saying a statement which impugns on an individual is not allowed. Or a statement that casts aspersions. It is allowed in the rules that if you have got an issue that you know about a member, bring a substantive motion that must be discussed in the House.
Yes.
But you can't hail a statement without verification. And I sometimes say it is important for us to also remember that we are representing the public. Our conduct must also speak to it. But also, we are adults. When children who watch this media, what message are we sending to them about how to conduct issues of difference? Because in the debate, you can differ with an individual, but still in a respective way. But when you degenerate into insult, I don't think it is good for members themselves nor our society, because it then makes people to doubt about is this institution a fora that really represents our views?
Mm. But when I get mama, jengo mama, or no moyo phansi, moyo wesonto. What have you done, or what are you doing to impress upon members in that way? Like, for instance, do you meet political parties or whips to talk about these things and say, but guys, look, we're all adults, we must conduct ourselves. Can you guys talk to your caucus?
We do that, the programming committee, we do that. The chief whips themselves, those issues get raised. But yeah.
It still continues.
Sadly.
What is to be done to do you think actually, is there a possibility of resolving the issue at all? I mean, as I say, this thing started in 2014.
To my this day, view it continues. Is, if society frowns upon and not glorify those things, the message, in my view, will be loud and clear.
Okay.
Because it's Tombis in this.
Yeah.
This is what mirrors our society. Is that how we want our society to be looked in, you know, at? Is that how we want it to be looked at? Actually, when you go around the continent, it's like we are a soap opera where people go to DSTV to watch South African Parliament. Not because of the substance all the time, but more the theatrics.
In fact, I was going to ask, Hori, what do your colleagues say? I mean, I've seen you've been busy in the African continent. What do they say, your colleagues from other parliaments, when they see you about those scenes that are beamed all over the internet so they can be accessed by anyone anyway?
As I say that, they actually wonder how even our society accepts that kind of behavior from its public representatives.
Mm.
But people aren't the same. Others actually feel that is a representative of the robustness of our democracy. So people will have different views.
Who reports to you as a speaker in parliament on a day-to-day basis? Okay, what I'm trying to get at, what is the job of the speaker? And other than, you know, this, you may assume people know this thing, they don't. Other than they see you there when it's a joint sitting, you know, that is on TV, they actually don't know that you have another work that you do beyond the camera. So on a day-to-day basis, when there's no joint sitting, what does the speaker do?
Let me say, you've got members of parliament that get elected as public representatives.
Yes.
But for them to be able to do their work, there is an administration, full-time staff members who deal with the work that supports parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of that institution is the speaker and the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. But then you have got an accounting officer who is the secretary of parliament. You have got the secretary of the National Assembly and the secretary of the
NCOP.
You've got, you know, the people that sit in front of the speaker, the table staff. They actually do a lot of work that supports the functioning of the house.